Game of Thrones.
Oh my God.
There's dragons.
You gotta watch it.
You see them. There's this fight scene. There's this hair. And some guy really
Winter's
small.
Winter's coming.
I'm really helpless. The guy from the season is going on. I'll see
you again. Watch your
ass. Now they're really amazing, though.
Is that a guy or a girl?
Like, seriously, we gotta see it. It's
what's
so
his name again?
It's
like a chicken. What does Jakari's mean?
And,
lost his hair.
Cool.
Hair. Fucking red wedding.
Cannot give you back your homes or restore your dead to life, but perhaps I can give you justice in the name of our king.
Jakari's.
Welcome back to the Coffee Klatch crew. This is Season 5, Episode 2, The House of Black and White. I'm Jason Pistorino.
I'm Christina Lomangino.
And this episode, right away, you can tell that Episode 1 was more of a setup, but diehard fans still enjoyed it, like you. You geeked out. But this one has a lot more going on. You know, they're still doing some setup, but they're starting to push the story forward with a lot of the characters.
Yeah, some viewers I know complained that they still didn't feel there was a lot of action happening here. But I think what made it interesting is typically each episode covers 5, maybe 6 locations. We had about 8 locations here, and we got a chance to cover almost all of our main characters that are relevant this season. So it was definitely quicker moving. Let's start off by talking about some general notes about the episode. The first, that this one, episode 42, was written by Benioff and Weiss, our producers, and directed by Michael Slovis.
Prince Doran is played by Alexander Siddig, known for his role as Dr. Julian Bashir on Star Trek, Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, him I don't know because I wasn't a Star Trek fan,
yeah,
but
I wasn't a Trekkie either.
This was a big deal for a lot of people. Also, Sir Dennis Malister was played by actor J.J. Murphy, who unfortunately died only 4 days after filming his first scenes at the age of 86. So now his watch has ended.
Oh, wow. Are they going to replace the actor? Or?
I don't think so. You kind of see in this scene where they're doing the election for the new Lord Commander, he doesn't even really have any speaking lines. So I think they did intend maybe for him to have a slightly larger role, but his character isn't that big in the book.
Okay. For season 5, the production team built expansive, fully realized sets for the streets and buildings of Braavos.
Oh, that's a big set right there.
Yeah, and I don't know if you noticed, they kind of, the opening scene of Braavos with the statue, I think they redid, that's all digital, and I think they redid that and added more detail from the last season. Because
okay.
There's going to be a lot more in Braavos.
Maybe to tie in these sets?
Yeah, and also it's, you know, Braavos is going to be more prevalent in this season. So I don't know how much, I know that in the book there's a lot that goes on in Braavos. But this season's only 10 episodes.
Yeah,
so.
Unfortunately for us book readers, I don't think we'll get to it all. But at least we are getting a really good view of it. We'll talk about that later, the city of Braavos. So we also saw another location for the first time being Dorne, and specifically the Water Gardens, which we found out was filmed at the Royal Gardens at Alcazar. And that's sort of a big deal because a lot of other people have tried to shoot there, but they haven't been allowed by the Spanish government. I think this was the first time a TV show was allowed to film there.
HBO's got some power. Myrcella was originally played by Amy Richardson in seasons 1 and 2. But after 2 seasons' absence, the producers decided to recast the role now that Myrcella prominently features in season 5. And the role is now played by Nell Tigerfree.
Nell Tigerfree? That's kind of an interesting name. yeah, so obviously she was younger when we first started out, but yet another new casting of a character.
Well, this one makes sense. We don't really know that character, so we haven't fallen for it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the actress... it's probably older now, maybe too old for the role, or it was such a small role that she didn't have to be that good of an actor yet.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they had to find a better actor.
Yeah.
We still haven't seen her talk. We saw her from afar this episode.
We think with Tristine, which is Doran's son, that she's supposed to be engaged to, but we're not sure yet, I don't think. So one last fun fact, according to Carrie Ingram, who plays Shireen, it takes about 3 hours to apply the full grayscale scarring makeup that's on her face just to that left side of her face, and about another 2.5 hours to take it off. So that's some crazy makeup work right there.
Especially for just half a face.
Yeah, can you imagine? So let's get into talking about our House of Black and White episode. It starts off just with the opening credits. I don't know if many people noticed, but when they're going through the different locations, they show Winterfell. And normally the castle flies on top the flag of the Direwolf for the Starks. But for the first time now, it was showing the Flayed Man on top, which is the Bolton symbol.
Yeah, and we missed that the first time. They showed it in episode one, but it's pretty fast
the
way they go by it, so you don't really see it. And it's red on top of the gold, so it doesn't pop that much. So you really got to be looking. And it's funny, once we figured that out, I was looking very closely for every other section.
Yeah.
If there was anything that changed. I was hoping when they showed Meereen that the big statue on the top, that
The harpy
in episode one that they pulled down,
would topple.
Be cool if they animated it toppling down. That'd be very...
Yeah, that would have been awesome. Well, that's a miss for them there.
Then I was thinking, like, they could do something on the wall because there's the king there.
Yeah, Stannis' symbol, maybe.
Yeah. I suck with names. I'm glad you're here because there's so many names in this show. Sometimes when we're watching the show, I have to just shut my brain off and enjoy the action because if I complicate it too much by trying to remember all these characters and their names, I don't enjoy the show anymore. So I kind of lean on you for that.
I think that's where the show is helpful, too, because you remember them by face a lot of times and what they're doing, even if you don't necessarily remember their names. But for those of you who do want to know, as we go through each section, we're going to talk about some of those characters that maybe you've forgotten their names or even why they're important. So we'll start out. We have a lot of locations to get through. Try to go through them quickly. The first area being Braavos. We get an opening shot of Captain Ternesio Terrace, in case you're wondering what his name was. And he's telling Arya a cute little anecdote as they're going underneath the statue. He says, in the old days, whenever Braavos was in trouble, the Titan of Braavos would step with fire in his eyes, wade into the sea, and smash his enemies. So the Titan is a massive stone and bronze statue that guards the entrance into the lagoon. It's the primary line of defense for Braavos and lets out a loud blast whenever a ship approaches to signal to warn the arsenal of its coming. So, you know, clearly he can't actually step out into the sea, but he is not merely a decoration. He's a stylized fortification that commands the only major passage into the harbor, and the statue's filled with murder holes. So the defensive garrison can rain down fire and burning oil on the enemy ships that try to pass through. In this only entrant. So he actually does defend the city.
You know, it's funny. Visually, I was thinking about that. I assumed it was the only entrance as well. But, and I'm skipping ahead and I apologize, but when Arya sees the House of Black and White, and they show a clip of kind of if you were standing in front of the House in Black and White and looking
out to the sea,
it's the sea that you see. And then to the right is big stone. And then over the stone on the opposing side is the statue. So technically, someone could get onto the House in Black and White.
Well, yeah, they're saying it's the only major entrance. And we do know that the House of Black and White is sort of on its own separate island, apart from the rest of the city.
Right.
And not a lot of people go there, so maybe they don't feel the need to defend it as well.
Also, I don't know if you noticed, but Arya has a little chuckle when they're speaking about that statue. I think because at this point, she's gone through so much. If you remember, it's hard to remember everything that she's gone through. She's had to act like a boy. She had to pretty much be a servant for Tywin.
At Harrenhal, yep.
And that's just like 1% of everything she's gone
through. She was taken in by the Brotherhood without banners.
That's right, yeah.
When her friend was killed.
Seen her family killed.
And
she's
then
seen
the
her
whole journey with the Hound.
Yeah. So she's looking at this and she just laughs at it. Like, there's no gods. She's pretty much like, all I have is me.
Yeah, there's no protection. Even if this is a story, a fairy tale, the world isn't safe.
Right. And she's very like, I am the only one that can protect myself. And remember I said that because when we get later on into the show, mm-hmm. that becomes important.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so we get this view of the city, which looks kind of Venetian with its boats and waterways. Very beautiful.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
And then she approaches the house in black and white, which aesthetically, this is a contrast to what we've been seeing. It's just this big stone building, kind of imposing, a little bit scary with this black and white door. In reality, this is a temple in Braavos dedicated to the god of death. It also serves as the headquarters of the guild of assassins known as the Faceless Men. It sits alone on an island in the lagoon, and although it can be reached by boat or bridge from other locations, it's usually deserted. So there really is nobody there when she gets there. She knocks on the door, and the old man comes and tells her that there's no one there by the name of Jake Nagar, and leaves her on the steps, we think, all night, just repeating her death list.
Yeah, even though I knew that Jaqen could change his face, I don't know about anybody else, but it did not occur to me that that could be him. Like, I just had no thoughts of that. I was like, oh, shit.
Well,
maybe he's still gone, and, you know, maybe he's left. He's still, because we met him. He wasn't, you know, he was doing his own thing. He was captured, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, well, last time we saw him, though, he had gotten free.
Oh, of course. I mean, the first time we met him.
Right, but we assumed that he was still somewhere around there in the Riverlands where we left him. And in fact, in the books, we kind of think that that's what happened, because that is the last time we see him. We don't see him here in the books at
that's
the House
right.
of Black and White. So it's just some old man. That's how they refer to it. So as she's going through this death list, I can't help but noticing how short it's gotten. There's only 4 names left on her list.
Yes, I did do some researching. I don't know how true this is, but apparently the show gave us a shorter list. She has a larger list than that.
She started out with a larger list than what the show gave us, too.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, proportionally, I guess, kind of it's changed the same amount. But the only people left on it now are Cersei, Walder Frey, the Mountain, and Meryn Trant. And it kind of begs the question, why aren't the Boltons on this list? Who technically were behind the Red Wedding, who have now moved in to take over her home of Winterfell. Does she know that? How could she not when traveling with the Hound? I mean, I don't know. They certainly would be on my list. So anyhow, she's out there all night. In the morning, she tosses the coin that she's been holding on. This is like her only thing that she has left into the water, and she leaves. And then we see her later in the streets trying to defend herself against, I don't know, pickpockets maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And the man comes back, seemingly kind of to protect her, and leads her back to the house where he gives her the coin. So we know he's got some power right there. How did he get that coin back? And he changes his face, and we see that it's Jaqen.
Yeah. Now, before we get to Jaqen, I really liked the scene where she stood up for herself. I thought that was good. She had no one there to back her up.
Mm.
And she kept just saying, like, turn around and walk away or something like that. Turn around and go.
Yeah.
And they were asking, what does she have? And is it worth anything? And she says, nothing's worth anything to a dead man.
Mm.
So essentially, I'll kill you if you try to. It's not worth it because I'll just kill you and your men.
And do you think she could have? Do you think she's progressed to the point where she can kind of take them?
I think she could have put up a good fight, but she's biting off more than she could chew at this point. She's got the needle,
mm-hmm.
and there's like 4 men. Maybe she could have survived enough to hurt them and get away.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it wasn't the point. I think it was the point that she's tough now. She's rough.
Yeah.
She's tough, and she's a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, and I think the quest, you know, to protect herself, how it started out with Syrio, the water dancer, teaching her to use needle,
right.
has turned into a bloodthirst now that she's got the death list, which maybe kind of started a little bit with Jaqen and her having these names to put on a list, and he could just make them disappear. And there's sort of been a fascination ever since then,
right.
that she could just make her enemies disappear like that. And then the turning point when she actually kills somebody with the Hound in the inn,
yeah,
and everything she's learned from him. You know, I think maybe she came to Braavos just looking for a friendly face because of everything that she had gone through. She had nowhere else to go. She thinks she has no family left. which perhaps was exactly the wrong thing to do because this is the House of the Faceless Men. Right. And, you know, maybe even if this guy is wearing Jockin's face, is he really Jockin? Was there ever really a Jockin, or was that just a mask that he put on? Is this the same man underneath? The wrong place to go for a friendly face, but maybe this will become her purpose.
Yeah, I don't think she was just going there for a friendly face. I think she wants to be trained.
You do?
Yeah, because she's relaying that list again.
Okay.
It's almost like she's comforting herself, like she's stuck out there. They're saying Jockin's not there, but she's saying to herself, this is the list, this is my goal, I need to train to kill these people. Stay positive, stay here, work at it. You need to train to kill these people.
So this is all I have left now is my vengeance.
Right. And she's turning to the faceless men to do so. I don't know. I got this like good feeling once he took his face off and it was Jockin. And I love what they say to each other.
Yeah. She asks,
who are you? You said there was no Jockin Hagar here.
A man is not Jockin Hagar.
Well, who are you then?
A man is no one, and that is what a girl must become.
So essentially what he's telling her is, well, it's very like Mr. Miyagi, son.
He's going to Miyagi her?
He's going to Miyagi her. The next couple of episodes are going to be him saying, wash my car, and wax on, wax off. But in so many words, he's saying to her that, and this is why I was saying, remember what I said about Arya.
Okay.
You have to let go of you. If you're going to be a faceless man, woman, it's not about you anymore. It's about you. I mean, the faceless men, they're part assassin, and they're part, it's kind of like a church.
Right.
Or religion, quote unquote. And the saying, what are the two sayings that they have?
Velar Mogulis, all men must die, and Velar Doharis, all men must serve.
Right. So all men must die, all men must serve. There's nothing self-righteous about that. It's not about yourself. And part of her training is not just going to be about fighting. It's going to be about, is she going to be able to let go of all of this self-need? Or not need. She's not needy, but she wants revenge.
Yeah.
And revenge is very self.
That.
She has to be selfless.
She has to serve.
Yeah. And in order for her to become think about it. A faceless man, they can change into any man. Maybe they can. Part of the magic is that they're not they did not cling on to themselves.
Right.
I'm not Jason Pistorino anymore. I am part of
whoever I need to be in that moment.
The faceless Lord,
right.
The faceless God, which is one of the seven.
That's what we got to figure out, is who do they actually serve? So, yeah, if you're saying the faceless God, that would be the stranger. And he is one of the seven of the new gods.
Right.
And one that people never talk about. You know, they talk about praying to each one of the other ones. If they are a cobbler, they pray to the smith. If they're a young girl, they pray to the maiden. Mm-hmm. And the stranger is always one that's left out because he symbolizes death. So it would seem very likely that maybe this religion is built around that, or maybe it's something we don't know about yet.
Well, I think this religion is built around all seven, and essentially it's this religion encompasses all seven. That's why it's the faceless man. I mean, it has qualities of all of them.
Sure. But they serve the stranger, basically.
If you go into the House of White and Black. In the book, you were saying there's like statues of the faceless man, right?
There's statues of all of them in
all
there.
All of them, right.
Yep.
So it's not just the faceless man. They are pretty much praying to all the gods, but it all engulfs this one.
Yeah, and I won't tell you too much about that because I'm hoping we'll get a view of that next time, what the inside looks like. But they do talk a little bit about what they're about, but the biggest thing, like you said, to start off with is just letting go of the personal aspect. And I think that's going to be something she struggles with.
It's
going to
be challenging. It's going to be a big struggle. Now, the House of White and Black, I know I'm kind of harping on this, but this is my favorite part of the episode. Faceless Man. They're the most skilled assassins in all the lands, quote unquote. They're also the most expensive. Do you remember in the episode, I think it was season one or season two, when the king's hand, the whole, his people?
Council.
Council, thank you. Were sitting and they were saying, how can we kill, oh, I forget who it was. They wanted to...
Daenerys?
Yes, how can we kill Daenerys?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, why don't we hire a faceless man?
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah, they do. It's very quick. And then one of the characters says, he's too expensive. They were so in debt.
That would be a change from the book then.
It was in the, yeah.
If they're hired.
It was quick and it was so long
ago. Because these aren't hired men in here. They're doing this for a purpose and I won't tell you what it is, but they're not for sale. It's kind of like what we saw with Jaqen and why he killed the people he did for Arya.
Right. Well, faceless men can't kill for selfish reasons. They either have to be killed for someone else or apparently they're for hire. And the high, like if I said, I just need this person who stole my, robbed me last week,
mm-hmm.
it won't be as expensive. But if I need someone like Cersei killed, it's going to be a lot of money.
Okay. So this could be a diversion, what they do with this then.
Yeah.
From the book.
And the type of people you're going to see in the House of Faceless Men are priests,
mm-hmm.
acolytes,
mm-hmm.
faceless men,
yep.
and people who come to worship slash die.
Yes, ask for the gift.
Ask for the gift of death.
Yep.
So it's going to be dark in there. It's going to be creepy.
Yeah, but you know, without saying too much, you brought it there a little bit, so I'll go there now. In the book, they only give that gift to certain people based on certain reasons. So we'll see if they keep to that here. And you know, lastly, before we move off Braavos, just a little thing about Braavos in general. They were founded by escaped slaves fleeing from the Valyrian freehold, who killed the masters, commanding a fleet of slave ships that were being transported in, and they sailed as far away from Valyria as they could. The original slaves were from across the world. So the Braavosi, it's not an ethnicity in and of itself. It's a cosmopolitan culture. You might find any ethnicity in the world. So right. This kind of ties in with Arya's story. People just fleeing, looking for sanctuary, coming from all different parts of the world and gathering here together. So that may or may not be important in the future. Okay, moving on to the Vale, where we see Brienne and Pod eating at an inn when they spot Littlefinger and Sansa, who have 10 men guarding them. And I gotta say, from here on out, this whole storyline seems like it's going to be completely different from the book. This episode is the first where we're starting to get major, major deviations in storylines. It's not just streamlining for character economy, making three characters into one. We're really breaking off now here. So I was sort of holding my breath the entire time, a little nervous to see where Benioff and Weiss were going to go with all of this. And I think my most questionable location and characters are here. I'm really waiting to see if they're going to be able to pull this off. So the first difference to me, in the books, Peter and Sansa never leave the Vale. And they never meet Brienne and Pod, whose stories kind of fade out at this point. And Littlefinger and Sansa's interactions are a lot more interesting. He's sort of teaching her. So she goes from, you know, steadily from a naive young girl that he finds in King's Landing, who is completely helpless at the mercy of all these other monsters, to teaching her to be a clever, scheming intellectual who learns how to play the games and think like him. And you can't tell throughout this entire book if she's actually becoming his protege or just learning to placate him and stay safe now that she's found herself with another monster and maybe to potentially plot against him in the end. So a lot juicier than what we're seeing here. But what we see here is Brienne approaching and trying to pledge her loyalty to Sansa. But Sansa denies it. And, you know, before that, we see that her Lannister backing is starting to get her into quite a bit of trouble in these situations, especially in the books, because Littlefinger says to her, Renly said your loyalty came free of charge, but it seems that someone's paid a lot for it since then.
And that's because she's decked out in that new attire.
Yeah. Very wealthy armor. She comes bearing this seal from, you know, King's Landing. And even Sansa says, I saw you at Joffrey's wedding, bowing to the king.
Right.
So they think she's a Lannister puppet.
You know, also, it's worth noting, last episode, I mentioned how she looked defeated, and I was like, how they, there's nothing left in her storyline. And also, while we're at that, I'd like to apologize. I was a little out of it last episode.
That's okay.
I hurt my right hand in softball, and they had me on some pain meds. So I was kind of And yeah, so if it was obvious that I was kind of not into it, it's just I couldn't concentrate.
Well, back in action now, though.
Yes. So anyways, Brienne, they're sitting, and they're she's just eating. She looks miserable. And Pod says, Sansa. And she's, don't look. And she, like, sprouts up. And a new, the spark in her eye that there used to be there before, it's like, it's the old hurt right away. And now she has purpose again.
See, I thought you meant Sansa when you said that, because she seems defeated with no purpose now as well.
I feel like she was more defeated in the past seasons when she had, she was just, like, trapped.
Okay.
She felt like she was enslaved. Now, I don't think she feels like she's enslaved anymore. I think she feels like she's part of this
scheme with Littlefinger?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I did get some of that feeling in the books, but I'm not getting it from the TV show. And I thought it was a little bit weird the way they handled her transformation wasn't first her attitude. It was just her coming downstairs one day with new hair and new clothes and boom, transformation. So they kind of missed the evolving of the character a little in the series. You know, but hopefully we're getting to the same place. Also, the chance meeting, you know, that she's been looking for these girls forever and ever. She can't find either one of them. Now, mysteriously, they're just in this inn together and they happen to see each other. It just felt a little too forced to me that they came upon each other this way. Yeah. But regardless, so Sansa denies Brienne. She doesn't want to have anything to do with her. She doesn't trust her. And it seems that Littlefinger's not going to let her go.
Right.
I don't know what he was planning to do with her, maybe kill her because he wants his little people to know about Sansa as possible. But if so, why are they in the middle of this crowded inn parading her around? I don't know. It's a little weird.
Well, if they, that's true. Yeah. If they were actually hiding her, quote unquote, why would they
why
be just
they
chilling
her? You know,
they're like sitting in the corner, but they have these guards standing around. So obviously if you walk in, even if you don't know who Sansa is, you're going to be like, that's an important person.
They're very conspicuous. And she's not exactly disguised. Her hair is darker, but it's still clearly Sansa.
Yeah, Littlefinger's not disguised. You know what, Clatchers? Christina and I, this is a good time to bring this up. Christina and I really want some more interaction. We feel like it'd be better if we started hearing from our listeners what their thoughts were about the Game of Thrones. And we have a great way to do it where you can email us at contact@coffeeclatchcrew.com.
Okay.
So again, contact@coffeeclatchcrew.com. We get the emails and we can hear from you. And the first question I have for you guys, do you think Brienne is stupid for wanting to pursue Sansa to try to help her, even though she's been said right in her face, we don't want your help.
She's been denied.
She's been denied, and it's the second time she's denied. You know, she's going to follow her now. That's obvious. And just watch her and make sure she's okay. Do you think it's stupid for her to do that, or is it just the fact that she's got nothing else in life? And she, you know, there's, she said last episode, I wanted to devote my life to a king.
A good king.
A good king, and there's no good kings left. So this is the last promise that she's made, last vow that she's made to a king, good king or queen.
Yeah, that she can follow through with.
Yeah. So do you think it's stupid of her? Do you think she should just go ahead and do something else?
Yeah, we want to hear your thoughts. This storyline in particular, I'm very eager to see. Like I said, the roadmap has ended with the books. And also, we're going to invite you to some more interaction later on in the episode with our new segment. So just to close out the veil, in the books, Brienne, you know, she doesn't run into Sansa. She continues to wander through the war-torn Riverlands, desperately hunting for the girls and witnessing firsthand the utter devastation caused by the war. Entire swaths of the region reduced to burned out ruins, and even with the war technically over, it would take a full generation to recover. So the only thing we're really missing out on is her view is showing us what actually happened to this country. We're not getting that from any character's point of view yet. But she really is just continuing to search. So now let's move on to King's Landing, where we open with a bang Cersei receiving a very clear message from Dorne. It's this little sculpture of a snake with its fangs holding a stag necklace, Myrcella's necklace.
Right.
So they're taking that as a clear threat to Myrcella. And Cersei goes on to berate Jaime for not being a father and telling him that his caution has not, in fact, kept their children safe.
Now, I believe that Cersei thinks that that's from Prince Dorne, but we as viewers know that it's from Alaria.
Alaria Sand, or from the Sand Snakes.
Right, Alaria Sand and the Sand Snakes.
We're not sure which, you know, Alaria Sand, we'll get to her later, but she was Prince Oberon's paramour. And she was clearly so upset about his death in the fight with the mountain. So she definitely is going to want revenge. But then you also have this group called the Sand Snakes, who we haven't met yet, that are Oberon's bastard children. So they're going to want vengeance as well. Another major deviation from the books here, Jaime says he's going to go to Dorne to bring her back.
Now, does he think this is going to be a peaceful thing, or does he think this is going to be a war?
I think if he thought it was going to be a war, he would take more people. I doubt if he thinks it's going to be easy. Maybe he thinks it'll be more of like a sneak-in, get-her-out type mission. I don't know because, you know, again, this didn't happen in the books. They never sent a threat. Jaime never goes to Dorne. In fact, his whole storyline takes a different route here. Instead, he goes to the Riverlands to take command of the ongoing siege of Riverrun, which is Catelyn's family's home.
This is in the book?
Yeah, and we last left that with Brynden Tully, her uncle, is the one who runs this castle. And he's been completely surrounded by the Freys since we left them. But he's defiantly continued to hold out for months after the Red Wedding. He won't let them take it. And so Jaime goes to try to negotiate that, and it takes a whole other path. So I don't know how they're going to reconcile that. This is a big, big change.
Maybe they don't feel that's important to the main story.
No, I guess not. I don't want to say too much. There are some things that may or may not play in. But anyhow, we then move to Cersei watching that people are bringing in imps' heads. She's looking for Tyrion. This is not Tyrion. And just a note here, although it's difficult to tell from the prop they used in the show, the severed dwarf's head that is presented to her is the dwarf who played Joffrey in the mock joust at the Purple Wedding.
Oh, I thought he looked familiar.
Remember he had that troop of dwarfs come in and do that little show?
Yeah.
That was one of those guys.
Okay.
So then we get a glimpse next, I think, at the most important part of this episode with King's Landing is her very pathetic small council of what she has left.
Yeah.
So she's got three people, really. She's got Mace Tyrell, who she asked to be Master of Ships and Coin. Grandmaster Pycelle, who's going to remain Grandmaster barely. She's, like, totally done with him. And her little puppet, Maester Qyburn, who she asked to be Master of Whispers. So let's for a minute just go over to Mace Tyrell. Some people are asking, who is this guy?
Who that be?
So he's the Lord of Highgarden and the head of House Tyrell. He's Marjorie and Loras's father and Lady Olenna's son.
He's kind of a bumbling idiot.
Yeah, she describes him as an oaf.
Yeah.
So, but he is in a position of power. He's the Lord Paramount of the Reach and Warden of the South. So each region, we learned a while back, has a warden, mm-hmm. one king to rule them all, but it's a little too much. Each one has to kind of maintain control of their area. And Warden of the South is no small thing, especially considering the Tyrells are one of the richest and most powerful families in Westeros, second only to the Lannisters. They have a significant army, and they have probably the greatest harvest of crops. So it does take a sort of able man to rule all that. Maybe he's not the most clever, but he is amiable and well-liked by his bannermen. So just another example of Cersei dismissing people that she doesn't see as important. She's really paying him no credence. She's giving him this role to placate him as Master of Coin, which you and I know is an impossible job.
Right, because they're such in debt.
Right. And then Maester Qyburn, who, if we've forgotten, he was one of the prisoners left at Harrenhal, left for dead by Sir Gregor Clegane way back when. He's a former maester of the Citadel who was stripped of his chain by the Archmaesters for engaging in forbidden experiments. In the books, he's rumored to practice black sorcery and necromancy.
So that's a dude that's taking place of Varys.
Yeah, new master of Whisperers.
Now, Varys was... He's a genius in his own right. So those are big shoes to fill.
Yeah, but we are getting a glimpse a little bit that even though he's disgraced and sort of questionable where a maester is concerned, he's not dumb. He's smart and he's got his own plans going on and he seems very loyal to Cersei already.
You're speaking in regards to where he was like, keep the head?
He's performing his experiments, but he's sort of shown in how he's gotten in the good graces and navigated King's Landing so far that he maybe can play this game, that he, for whatever reason, wants to be loyal to her, and that's what she's looking for.
He's Frankenstein.
I think he's going to have his own part to play.
He's Frankenstein.
But the only real able person left to her is her uncle, Kevin, who she asked to be Master of War. Now, in the book, she asked him to be the Hand of the King, which is the next highest position.
Right.
There is no title Master of War here.
But she declares that no one's going to be the Hand until her son, the King, is old enough to declare a Hand, which is essentially keeping her in control.
Absolutely. Now, in the show, Tommen is apparently already past the age of legal minority. So she technically is no longer his regent. She's just Queen Mother, which Kevin points out to her. She has no right to sit on the council if she's not a regent. In the books, she still is technically the queen regent because Tommen's only 9 years old.
He looks older than 9 in the show.
Yeah, the show they made him older.
Oh, okay.
He is older, but in the books he's still young. The reason Kevin denies the request to be Hand is before he died, it was Tywin's intent that Cersei return to Casterly Rock and have no further say in the governance of the realm or Tommen's upbringing. So Kevin demands Cersei name him regent to rule until Tommen comes of age and that she leave King's Landing. And she responds by throwing wine in his face.
This is in the book?
Yeah.
That might have been cool to watch.
So she really screws her opportunity to have one very able, smart person on her council, and she thinks she's just gonna do it all.
Do it.
Okay, so let's move on to a smaller segment where we visit a new place, Castle Stokeworth, where we see Bronn on the beach with his new fiance, Lallys.
Wait, before you bring that, what was the thing you just said? House of Castle Black or something? What was that?
Casterly Rock.
Every time I hear someone say that in the show or when you speak it, I feel like that should be where the next huge rock concert happens. Like the new Woodstock. You know, it goes down 2015, Castle Rock, and people talk about that for years, just like they talk about Woodstock. Doesn't it feel like someplace where there's like, it's going to be a party?
Well, maybe if you didn't know. If you didn't read the books, to me it seems like anything but. Well, not necessarily that. Just I don't know, a little more. Like they're the wealthiest place in the kingdom.
Yeah,
and well respected for the Lannister name. And I don't know why we haven't seen them ever in the books or the show.
Because they're not fighting. They're having concerts. Dave Matthews is there. They're like, Casterly Rock, we love you.
Okay, we're going to move on to Bronn on the beach with Lallys. So if you're wondering who Lallys is, she's a noble lady second in line for inheritance of Stokeworth. In the book, she's morbidly obese and considered simple. And she was a victim in the riot of King's Landing, where she was ambushed and gang raped by 50 men in Fleabottom, which resulted in her pregnancy with a bastard child. So after this, she was considered defiled and left a social pariah at court. Nobody wanted to marry her. Actually, her mother kept trying to push Tyrion on her Tyrion was still here because he couldn't get a better match. But this actually makes her ideal for Bronn, who is an up-jumped sellsword, really, and is considered too low for highborn matches.
He's worked his way up.
And clearly, that setup was manufactured by Cersei. And it would seem that Bronn has plans on her older sister, who would inherit the castle. But before that can come to pass, Jaime walks up and says that...
Wait, hold on. I thought this was so telling. There's two things that happened when they were speaking to each other.
Okay.
First, Baran was like, he looked very positive. He was almost skipping, but in his like cool, like Baran kind of way when they were walking together.
Right.
Did you notice that?
Yeah.
And
he's on top of the world.
His chin was up. Yeah. And he's like, she's talking about, well, first he's like, this castle's going to be ours. And she's like, no, we're not going to live here.
Yeah, my older sister.
My older sister is. And she's kind of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And she still hits me now.
She pulls my hair. It's real simple.
And, you know, he's very confidently, he's like, I think you're a good person. And your sister is a mean person. I've been all over the world. And if there's one thing I've learned, it's that meanness comes around. People like your sister always gets what's coming to them eventually, one way or the other. Now, there's two things that I noticed.
Mm-hmm.
One that you pointed out, and once you said, I was like, oh, yeah, duh. He's already scheming.
Yeah, he's got designs to take her out of the plan. He wants that castle.
She's going to be out, and we're going to be in there, because this is my next stepping stone.
Yep.
That huge castle, that looked huge, by the way.
If I went from nothing to where I am now, then why not?
Exactly. So that was one. The second thing that I thought was great, and that's why I stopped you, is that right after he says that, his eyes are averted to a figure staring at him, sitting confidently on the stones, and it's...
Jaime.
And Jaime has something for him to
coming
do.
Along to ruin his plans.
And meanness comes around.
Sure. Yeah.
I've learned. So it's kind of ironic, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Because you know this isn't going to turn out right. This isn't going
to
turn out well.
This isn't a man who's meant to rise to the top, ever.
No, and this is going to just demolish all of his plans, even though Jaime promises him something better.
Yeah, but look, Cersei promised him this, and look how quickly that got dashed. So who's to say he's going to follow through with his promises either? Everybody's here to use Bronn. I think the only one who actually ever intended to help him was Tyrion. I think he really meant it, that he would...
Tyrion really loved him.
Would help him out.
As far as Tyrion could.
So he's going to be used by another Lannister now. And, you know, I thought the pairing of Bronn and Tyrion was great, and I didn't want to see Bronn's character go away. In the books, he marries Lollies. He never goes anywhere. That's the end of that, sort of. So I'm a little bit interested to see what this arrangement of Jaime and Bronn will look like. And I think that I mentioned before, when Jaime is training to try to use his other hand in order to fight, they don't use Bronn. They use the headsman,
mm-hmm.
Sir Ilyn Payne, because he has no tongue. It's been removed a long time ago.
Right.
He can't talk. He can't tell anybody about what's going on, that Jaime can't, in fact, fight with his left hand. So I think that Weiss and Benioff were looking to the future,
mm-hmm.
when they decided to make that Bronn instead of Ilyn Payne, that they were going to continue to use his character in this big change around. So they kind of kept him relevant for us.
Well, he was a great character, too. I really enjoyed him.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of Jaime's right hand, do you think they had the pills for Jaime that the doctors gave me? Because my right hand is hurt.
Yeah, they called it milk of the poppy.
Oh, which is probably better. It's opium, right?
Opium. And we know that from when we saw the mountain get so horribly, horribly injured. And they were trying to give him milk of the poppy, because that's what you would take for pain. You would drink it. And they said he had been so used to it, he drank it the way other men drank beer, that it had no effect on him.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was their painkiller right there.
I was just thinking, imagine Jaime doing a podcast, and then my mind just brought it out. Like, imagine if we could have the characters doing podcasts.
It'd be great.
Oh, my God. Just imagine this podcast, and we actually had the characters as real people. And what would they talk about? You know?
Well, and who would you most want here, really?
I'd fucking want...
Tyrion.
Yeah.
That's got to be your number one, right? All right, so let's keep it moving on to Dorne, which we are seeing for the first time. Very beautiful, because we're seeing the Water Garden section, which is Prince Dorne's retreat. But the rest of the kingdom is really made up of sun and sand. It's hot weather, hot people, very passionate. And so Dorne is the southernmost part of the continent. It's the southeast of Westeros, the Seven Kingdoms. If you went all the way down, it sort of comes off on a little peninsula. And it's cut off from the rest of them by a region of mountains, so sort of self-protected. And again, we discussed this before, that they are part of the Seven Kingdoms, but kind of an independent region unto themselves. What makes them special is they are the only ones that managed to fight off the dragons in the last attacks, where they kind of decimated every other area. These people were able to do that, so we wondered if they would ever come back for that reason. And it's a completely different people, different culture, and we get just a little view of that here. So they open up with Alaria Sand watching Myrcella, who we think is with Tristine, and then going to speak to...
Watching Myrcella and Tristine.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
She has a cool bracelet that I want. I mean, it's a chick's bracelet, but it's a snake. They started and zoomed on that snake.
Oh, I didn't even see it.
And it was cool. It's like wrapped around her wrist, and then the snake head goes around into in front of her knuckle.
Well, she's just badass, this woman, period. She's very powerful, and, you know, that's another thing about Dorne, is that women can be in positions of power here. They have a little bit of a different outlook on them.
And we know she's part of the Sand Snakes.
It sounds like they are making her that in the TV show, yes. In the book, she was not.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, so, okay, we get our first glimpse of Prince Doran Martell. Let's talk a little bit about him. He's the head of House Martell, the ruling prince of Dorne, the lord of Sunspear. He's the older brother of Oberon and Elia, and that's who Oberon was fighting for when he came to fight the monster, the revenge of his sister Elia.
I miss Oberon.
You raped her, you murdered her children,
he
blah,
was so
blah, blah.
Cool. You killed my father, perpetrator. Wrong show.
So Dorne also has three children, and in this scene in the book, we get to see Princess Arianne. Not sure why we don't see her here. Prince Quentin, his son who's off on a mission somewhere, and Prince Tristane, the one that's engaged to Myrcella, all of who were born of his wife, Lady Melario of Norvos, and she's not around. So he suffers from a severe case of gout. This is what prevents him from walking and restricts him to that wheelchair we saw him in.
Now, here's the thing, before you go on. Mm-hmm. First time I watched it, I didn't realize that he was in a wheelchair. I thought he was just sitting on a special king chair, you know?
Right.
Because the wheelchair is very decorative.
Yeah.
And just the second time, because they kind of pan to him, you see the wheel on it.
Mm.
And that's when I asked you, I was like, is he in a wheelchair?
Yep.
So, yeah, I didn't realize at first. Maybe they spoke about it last season. I don't think they did.
They spoke about it when they were asking. Tyrion went out to meet him.
I remember
and
that.
He didn't come. And they talked a little bit about his illness keeping him in. And then at the Purple Wedding, they talked about the fact that he had gout. And Oberyn called it the rich man's disease.
Now, why is it the rich man's disease?
Well, he was trying to kind of make light of it because a lot of times it can come from a very diet of rich foods.
Oh.
And I think he was also trying to play it down a little bit. And we find out the reason for that is Doran hides his disability. And maybe that's why his wheelchair doesn't look like a wheelchair. So as not to appear weak to his potential enemies and also his people, who really want somebody strong ruling them. So instead, while he's still in command of his wits, he is semi-retired to this water gardens palace and delegated much of the day-to-day running of Dorne to Oberyn. And that makes you wonder what's going to happen now that he's gone. And they were also complete opposites. So, you know, Dorne is described as cautious, a pensive man who does not wear his emotions on his sleeve and weighs the consequences of every action before he makes them.
Yin and yang.
Yeah.
They were the yin and yang. Just like us. I'm the smart one. You're the goofy one.
Yeah, well, it does sound completely opposite to Prince Oberyn.
Yeah.
And clearly, Alaria.
Oberyn, hot-headed, very skilled,
mm-hmm.
revengeful.
Passionate.
Sexual, men and women, and the other guy's very opposite.
Yeah, and, you know, the same with Alaria, and she's really pushing vengeance here. And he tells her, you know, the way she wants vengeance is to take it out on Myrcella. So Doran says, we do not mutilate little girls for vengeance. Not here, not while I rule.
Yep.
And she says,
go fuck yourself.
And how long will that be?
Oof.
So that's pretty...
But revenge on what, Christina? this guy wanted to fight. This was his fight. He volunteered to do this.
It's more about the backstory here. And we talked a little bit about this last season. Ilya, which was Oberyn's sister, she was raped and murdered, and her two children were also murdered by the mountain. Very, very bloody. We talked about that. And Dorne was very upset ever since then, asking for revenge for that. And basically, they knew that it was at the command of the Lannisters, that it wasn't just the mountain going rogue, that the mountain was the Lannisters' puppet, and that if he did something, it was because they told him to. And so they've been pissed ever since then. And when the Lannisters did nothing about it, that's when they sent Oberyn in to say he was going to get vengeance in his own way. Mm-hmm. And part of that was taking up this this challenge for Tyrion so he would have the opportunity to fight the mountain.
Okay.
So really it was because they weren't getting what they were asking for from the Lannisters. And in their mind, they still haven't. You know, now to make things worse, instead of getting revenge, Oberyn was killed as well. So, you know, these are a passionate, angry people who want something done to rectify this situation. And now, in the worst possible stroke of luck, they have hold of Cersei's daughter. Mm-hmm. So she really should have done something to placate them long ago.
But they're treating her well, it looks like. She seems happy, she's chilling, she's walking around in that beautiful garden.
Yeah, but we're learning that that's probably because of Prince Doran. And so what would happen if wasn't in the equation? That's what it leads you to kind of question.
Before we move off of that, there was that big, big black dude with that huge, it was what was it, like a straight axe or something?
A spear.
Spear, but it was more than a spear. It was a, what?
The Sun Spear is the name of where they live, so they carry these spears to protect themselves.
And he looks badass. I bet Bronn ends up fighting that dude.
Ooh, I wouldn't give Bronn a fighting chance against that guy. He looks pretty badass. I'm glad you brought him up. His name is Aryo Hota, and he protects Prince Doran.
That's great. Another name for me not to remember.
Well, you won't forget his face, though. He seems like a very intense inner character.
Intense, badass, and when I really like a badass character, they end up killing him.
Okay, so we got three more locations. Let's move next on to Meereen. So we open up with Daario telling Grey Worm that the Unsullied are too conspicuous. They're going through the streets of Meereen looking for the Harpy's son. And he's telling him that the second sons know how to blend in, to spy and get information, to be clever, not just fearless, because sometimes that's what the job calls for, and that makes them better equipped to kind of suss out the Harpy's son. Mm. And, you know, in fact, he's sort of right. She has this army of men who are fearless, willing to do whatever she says, but they can't really think for themselves. They're not really crafty the way Daario is.
No, they're not.
So he does find this guy. And then we go back to...
Oh, but you're skimming over one of my favorite scenes.
Okay.
When they're searching for the dude, again, when they were walking there, he was talking about... essentially, I think Grey Worm was like, what are we doing here? How are we doing this?
And
there's
nobody in this room.
Well, even before that, he was explaining, sometimes we you know, break hands. This is what I got of it. We break hands, we break souls, or we break spirit, and that's mm-hmm. how we find out. So, some guy, this is how we find out what's going on over here.
Yeah.
And then he comes in, there's no one here, let's go. And he goes, are you scared? And he says, Grey Worm says, we do not have fear.
Yeah.
And he said, you understood fear once, long ago, but you've forgotten what it means. Someone who's forgotten fear has forgotten how to hide. Mm. Fear is useful that way. And just puts his knife into the wall,
mm-hmm.
and it's a faux wall, and
that's where he's hiding.
Yep.
Yep.
I thought that was great. That made me like Daario even more.
That's why she needs him. That's what I'm saying. You got these 8,000 Unsullied, yeah. but none of them could have gotten that job done. She needs more Daarios.
She needs both, yeah.
The Sons of the Harpy, they're not just masses of people to be, taken over or burned the way she did in other cities. She's trying now to learn how to control and rule. And so these are masters that are clever. They have gotten to this position of ruling for many years.
Yeah. for a
somehow, for a reason. So she needs to figure out how to deal with them. And, you know, that's going to bring us to our next problem with her trying to figure out how to deal with them. She kind of marched into this city on the platform that she was there to free the slaves, right, to help the slaves. But now she finds herself in a position, if they're all equal, she has to also stand up for the rights of the masters as well. She has to offer justice for everybody.
And we touched upon this last episode. This is her struggle. This is her fight right now. She's trying to be a diplomat versus a tyrant, which is like her father.
And they how make she that, was starting out to be.
Right. And they make that prevalent when she has, when, what's his name? The old dude.
Yeah.
Talks to her after their meeting.
Yeah. So first we see like her version of a small council, which is pretty pathetic. You have Barristan Selmy, who is helpful. But getting a little bit old, maybe has his own ideas about things. You have Dario, who is helpful in his own way, but no politician. You have Hisdar Zolorak, who's a former master, and Mosador, I don't know how you say his name, who's a former slave.
What happened to that other cat? Did he die? I forget.
Jorah Mormont. Now, yeah, her council is begging for men like Jorah Mormont, who she exiled.
That's right.
Because she found out he used to be a spy for
her. Are we going to see him again? You think?
I certainly hope so. I think he was a very good character. And
Brienne's going to run into him.
Good for her council.
Or maybe he's going to end up doing that storyline that...
that I said was being cut out?
Yeah. That Jaime was supposed to do. Maybe he ends up doing that.
In Dorne. Well, there was the Tyrion storyline, too. So there's possibilities here to streamline characters. But, yeah, we're definitely missing him on the council here. She's got all these people with completely differing viewpoints, and she's sort of at a loss of where to go. Barristan urges that they teach these people a new way. Of course, the former slave tells her the masters only understand blood. And so afterwards, Barristan takes her aside and tells her about the Mad King. And he explains to her in the book about the Targaryen madness, which she at first doesn't want to hear, but she's very interested in it. And it's a noted strain of insanity that ran through their bloodline. It was the result of multiple generations of inbreeding, incestuous marrying brother to sister to keep the bloodlines pure. So based on the example of her father, who burned and murdered enemies alive, leading to the rebellion that killed all but two Targaryens because he thought it was justice, there's no guarantee that Daenerys will not also suddenly, without warning, turn violently insane at some point. And I think he's very, very worried that she doesn't seem to be her father, but that could happen someday. And he wants her to make the right decisions and not turn into that kind of Targaryen that her brother seemed to be, if we remember, with Viserys. Yeah. So I think it's unfortunately that talk that leads her to say, let's not kill this guy, let's give him a fair trial, where that probably wasn't her initial instinct, maybe. And it's done in the worst possible way. So, you know, this former slave winds up killing the master they were holding, thinking he's helping Dany. And she decides that he needs to be brought out for public execution. Is there a reason this had to be done in front of everybody where the tide could turn on her like this?
I think she thought she had to make up for the fact that it's not just about the ex-slaves. It's also about the ex-slave
masters being equal.
Being equal. So she had to make up for the fact that one of the slave masters got killed.
Yeah, but here's where the equality gets confused, because this a former master was taken in. She said, we're not going to kill him. We're going to give him a fair trial. But then when the slave turns around and commits the same action of murder, she doesn't give him a fair trial. She brings him out for immediate execution.
You're right.
And it leads the people, I think, to say, well, this master was going to get a fair trial, but the slave's going to get executed. Where is the equality in that?
I love when they all hiss.
Yeah, they turn on her. Like, whoa. So even if she was going to kill this guy, right? She could have done it quietly.
Yeah.
Without anybody knowing. She
first
could have.
Mistake.
They didn't even know. You don't think that the public even know that the master killed somebody and was taken in for a trial. So nobody needed to know about any of that.
Big political mistake. Very big. And there's going to be fighting in the streets.
Which there was. Master to slave already. there was...
She's losing control. Maybe... I can't wait for Tyrion to get there because he can help this. Maybe Tyrion meets up with that dude that was exiled.
Jorah.
Yeah. Maybe they meet up.
That
and then
would be good.
Jorah, like, explains what's happening.
You could see Tyrion, Varys, and Jorah. That's a great council now. That's what she needs for the advice. But now the question will be, will they all get to her? Is that where they're all going? Will she listen? And will that happen fast enough? Because it seems she's very quickly losing control of this kingdom. And is she supposed to stay in rule? Is that what her goal was? Is that what she should do? She's not one of these people. She clearly doesn't understand their culture. This isn't her home. In the book, this whole time, all she ever wanted was to go back to this home that she was forced to leave and bring them good rule. And she's gotten very sidetracked. So maybe would it perhaps be better if these people wanted her gone and she was forced to go back and pick up her original mission of a Westeros that needs her, not these people that don't want her?
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, everybody that I'm listening to is saying the same thing. This is begging for Tyrion to come. Everyone seems to think that would solve this problem and that needs to happen really soon. What I think needs to happen even worse than that is her regaining her connection with the dragons, because what made her so formidable was not that she had an army of Unsullied. Anybody could go out and buy that army. It was that she had dragons, and more so that she had dragons who seemed to
love her
and defer to her. Mm-hmm. That made her special. She had control over them. She couldn't be burned when they blew flame at her. She was able to do something with them. I mean, that's why her people followed her.
I mean, our intro
out of
has
the Red
that,
Waste.
Yeah, our intro has the part where she tells them to burn the slave master.
Yeah, that's what made her a different ruler, somebody that the people needed. So, you know, she's kind of, A, gotten sidetracked from her mission to Westeros, but B, gotten sidetracked on her children.
Yeah.
And we come back to that on this last scene, which doesn't happen in the books. I'm happy it happened here, where we get a view of Drogon, finally.
Now, do you think Drogon saw what happened with her?
I'm questioning a lot of this as well. Did he come to her because she was in need? Is there still that connection and he knew that and he's like sort of coming to reassure her? Was this tenderness at all? She didn't actually get a chance to touch him. He leaned in sort of when she went to touch him. He flew away. We haven't established yet. You know, we know for sure she's kind of lost control of
they're
the other two.
They're teasing us. Yeah, they're teasing us.
But Drogon was always special. He was always different.
Right. Which goes, remember I had the two options with her? Either she gets control of the two and they help to get control of Drogon.
Or she gets control of Drogon.
And
which
she
I
goes in there and Drogon's
going
to be like talking to them.
Yeah. Drogon is her boy.
Listen, dudes.
Drogon is her boy. I see that being more likely, and I see that being of the utmost importance. Like, if I was her, I would say, fuck these people. I'm going to find my fucking dragon. I'm going to find my child.
Very important. I love when dragons are there. You know that. That's my favorite part. But let's move really quick to Tyrion.
Yeah, our last two places. The first one is on the road.
Now, every scene where there's Varys and Tyrion, they are two very smart characters, two very witty.
Brilliant interactions.
Every time they're on the screen, I know there's going to be 100 quotes that are going to be brilliant. I know their interaction is going to be just like this cunning, kind of like a chess game.
Yep.
And every move, everything they say has a reason.
Intellectual.
It's so beautiful. I'm so glad that they have them both together. My favorite part, character-wise, interactively, are them two.
And they do have a very complex conversation here about leading and about their roles as outcasts and the fact that nobody will ever see them as leaders, but they are always the men behind the scenes actually making things happen.
Yeah.
And that in a sense they shun other people too because they're not accepted, but they can't ever take themselves out of the mix. This is what they were meant to do.
Yeah. And Varys, I feel like what he's trying to do is rebuild Tyrion. Tyrion, last episode, was a broken man.
Yep.
And he keeps saying, when Tyrion brings up something bad that he's done, he keeps bringing up good things that he's done. He's trying to rebuild this
broken
man.
And he still has a purpose.
And Varys looks into Tyrion as his next move, like to help him with the next move. Not use him, but help him.
Guide him.
Yeah. And you can see remnants of that. He's still kind of broken when you see him, mm-hmm. but he's more Tyrion, more of the old Tyrion than what we saw last episode.
Well, and for a long, long time, I didn't know if Varys was more or less of a creature like Littlefinger. I didn't know where his true loyalties lied. With all of his interactions with Ned Stark, I still wasn't sure what side he was on. But I'm now starting to believe for the first time that he is what he says he is. That he wants peace, that he wants a good ruler, and that he wants to help that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Going on Tyrion being back to being Tyrion again, when they're talking about Cersei, Tyrion says, the best part of her for the best part of me. And that's when he's saying that Tyrion wants a piece of you.
Yep.
And so Cersei has offered her lordship to the man who brings her your head. She ought to offer her cunt, best part of her for the best part of me. I love it.
Well, she offers it up enough, right?
That's true. And I don't know. That's another of the clever banter between each other.
Yeah.
You know, and again, Varys is trying to just give him another reason. Just push him to, this is what we have to do. This is our goal. And you should be not happy. I need you to be on board with this.
Yeah.
And when Tyrion has something to say, you know, he'll say, like, we've already got a ruler. Everywhere's already got a ruler. Every pile of shit on the side of the road has someone's banner hanging from it.
Mm-hmm. His negativity. But I think that's why it's good. They're making it sound like this will be kind of a long journey to go to Volantis and then to Meereen. So I think as viewers, we're hoping that that gives him the time we need to kind of come back to himself and be the person that Daenerys needs him to be by the time he gets there.
Yeah. They're trapped in this box, albeit a beautiful box.
Yeah.
Better traveling than Daenerys ever had. She had to walk the desert.
Yep. Beautiful litter with food and wine and, you know,
little
couches to lounge on.
Varys is explaining that he feels the same way as Tyrion. We've always felt this way, the type of people we are.
Yeah.
They will never follow us. They find us repulsive, and we find them repulsive, which is why we surround ourselves with large, comfortable boxes to keep them away. Yet no matter what we do, people like you and me are never really satisfied inside the box.
Nope, it's their destiny. He, you know, Tyrion says it, that Shae begged him to leave King's Landing, but he secretly liked the power. He couldn't do it.
Yeah. So I'm just excited to see where their story goes.
Definitely. And now moving on to our last location, which needs a little time to talk about. It's my favorite, what's going on here. And also the only area that I think is keeping the most true to the book still, which is the Wall, where we open with Shireen teaching Gilly to read and talking to Sam. And they're talking about grayscale. So let's talk about that for a second, Jason. We don't really know fully what it is from watching the TV show. It's a dreaded and unusually fatal disease that can leave flesh stiff and dead, the skin cracked and flaking, mottled black and gray and stone-like to the touch. Those that manage to survive a bout with the illness will be immune from ever contracting it again, but the flesh damaged by the ravages of the disease will never heal. It generally affects children, especially in cold, damp climates. The victims are left disfigured, but they become immune to the gray plague, the rarer, mortal form of the affliction. Grayscale is considered a death sentence if contracted as an adult, so children have a slightly better chance of surviving it. For adults, it kills very slowly, leaving its victims to suffer as the flesh deteriorates.
Chickenpox.
Way worse. And in its final stages, listen to this, the disease turns inward, causing the flesh of muscles and organs to harden and die, just like the skin in the outer tissue layers. It was believed that cutting off any infected appendages could prevent it from spreading throughout the body, which sometimes worked, but not always. So this is a really horrible disease that... I think we're wondering this whole time, how did Shireen survive it? And, you know, we find out here that children were more likely to survive it. However, they were looked upon differently, especially by wildlings. They talk about in the book that some of the wildlings couldn't bear to be around Shireen, and they considered her unclean. Mm-hmm. And that even if you survived it, the children who got it north of the Wall, they killed them because this was like a bad thing.
It probably remind them too much of walkers, right?
Well, yeah, and I think that they didn't...
White walkers, excuse me.
There was some bigger importance because they wouldn't have spent a whole scene here at the Wall where there's so much going on talking about this for nothing. It had to have some meaning.
She's got cooties.
So then we move on to this interaction with Stannis, where I really thought Jon Snow was going to be in big trouble for giving Mance mercy. And the interaction doesn't go down that way at all. It starts out where, you know, Stannis is a little bit upset. He tells him about this message that he received from Lyanna Mormont, the former commander's niece of Bear Island. So Stannis had asked for their allegiance, and she sends back this very cute note saying, "Bear Island knows no king but the king in the north, the Starks." And coming from a child, this got him very upset, but it made him think and understand the fact that the North is really only going to follow a Stark because they're so loyal to them. So, of course, this gives Stannis some schemes that he wants to go through. And he tells Jon, "I don't punish men for bravery, I reward it. And you can give me the North." Jon tells him that he couldn't because he's a bastard, and here comes the big moment where Stannis offers as a king to legitimize Jon and make him a Stark.
"Kneel before me, lay your sword at my feet. Pledge me your service and you'll rise again as Jon Stark, Lord of Winterfell."
And this was all Jon ever wanted, was to be a legitimate son of Eddard Stark, but in a strange move, he refuses it. And actually, this is what makes him such a Stark. He's so much like Ned in that he believes very strongly in honor and duty. He made a promise to the Night's Watch, and he's not going to break it.
"It's the first thing I ever remember wanting. I dared dream that my father would ask the king, and just like that, I would never be the bastard of Winterfell again."
Yeah, and that's an opportunity he couldn't have gotten anywhere else at any other time. He just happened to look into this, and I'm sure it was not an easy decision. They didn't show this internal struggle that Jon went through, but in the book, he really deliberated over this for days, and he didn't know what he was going to do until the last minute.
"I swore a vow to the Night's Watch. If I don't take my own word seriously, what sort of Lord of Winterfell would I be? I'm an idiot, and I'm going to stay here."
Yeah, and you kind of think that this is a bummer until we move on to the scene of Maester Aemon presiding over the election for the next Lord Commander. And the people are talking up two candidates, one being Alistair Thorne and the other Sir Dennis Malister of the Shadow Tower, when Sam grows a pair and interrupts to propose Jon Snow.
Oh, I love his rebuttal. So good.
It was a great speech. I mean, he really impugns Jaina Slynt for his cowardice in the battle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was so good.
And talks about how
he's no longer a coward like he used to be.
Oh, definitely not. And he talks about Jon Snow in a way that makes you tingle inside. He says he is the commander we turned to when the night was darkest.
Yep. He may be young, but he's the commander we turned to.
Mm-hmm. So the vote comes in, and it's a tie until we realize that Maester Aemon hasn't voted. And he puts his chip in, and Jon wins. Now, in the books, this goes on a very long time because you cannot have a tie. And initially, it's these two that are up for the election back and forth. And finally, Sam convinces them to vote for somebody else, being Jon Snow. And he uses a very clever trick that we don't see here by teaching some of these ravens, who are actually very smart. We haven't gotten to see a lot of that in the show. But that's part of Sam's job in the book, is to tend to the ravens who send messages throughout the kingdom, and they can say a few words. So there's this one raven who starts to say Snow, and Sam helps him to learn the word and repeat it. And the day of the election, one of the ravens flies to Jon's shoulder and starts saying, "Snow, snow, snow." And so they all think it's a sign, and, you know, the votes rush in and Jon wins. So, yeah, perhaps a different future than we expected for Jon, but that'll be interesting to see what happens with him as Lord Commander.
It's going to be a much tougher fucking life being Lord Commander.
Yeah, it's no party that Sam has just put him up for.
No,
he didn't agree to that. He didn't talk to him about that. He just volunteered him for this shit position.
Lord of the losers, basically. I mean, the good fighters have died. Most of them in that last battle. There's a few left, but it's mainly ex-cons and
thieves, rapers, and they're going to have to be the first front against the terrors that lie in the north that are going to come now that winter is coming. the White Walkers and all of that. And he's going to be the one to have to lead them. So I thought that was the best part of this whole episode. I can't wait to see Jon as Lord Commander.
Now, write into us. contact@coffeeclatchcrew.com. So contact@coffeeclatchcrew.com. Put in the subject line what you're writing about. And one is every podcast, we're going to ask you who your favorite character of that episode was. So we want you to write in the subject line, favorite character, episode 2, season 5. Tell us who your favorite character was.
And why.
And why, of course. Mine was, oh, there were so many to pick from, but it was still Arya. I love the storyline. We have a new... we have a new place that we're going to, and she stands up for herself, and she's with one of my favorite characters, Jaqen.
And mine was definitely Jon Snow for this speech that Sam gave, pushing him forward as Lord Commander.
Plus, you think he's a hunk.
Oh, of course.
So you can also put in your email to us, because he's a hunk.
Kit Harington is sexy.
We'll agree with that. It's fine.
And the last segment that we're going to start up, something we call Wolf Watch. And we really need your help in interacting with this one, because I think this is something important that the show initially seemed to agree with and since then has sort of faded out with the direwolves. So we're going to go through the different direwolves and, you know, who they are and where we last saw them. We're wondering why the show has let them drop, even though characters like the dragons have become so important to Dany, and the wolves seemed like they were going to be the same thing for the Starks. So what we're going to ask you to do is write in whenever you see a sighting of one on an episode, whenever they show a direwolf, tell us which wolf it was, where you saw them, and what will happen next. And particularly, the one wolf who is at large is Nymeria. So this was Arya's direwolf, and the one wolf that we really don't know the whereabouts. So write in and tell us your predictions. Where do you think Nymeria is? Is she still alive? Where did she go? What is she doing? And when are we going to see her again? And if you're right about this, maybe you'll get some kind of giveaway from CKC.
Help me out. What wolves are alive and who's died?
Yeah. Okay. So there were initially 6 direwolves. The first was Grey Wind, Robb Stark's. Grey Wind is deceased. He accompanied the main Stark army to the south and was killed at the Twins by the Freymen with crossbows during the Red Wedding. Second was Lady, Sansa's dog. She's also deceased. She was killed by Ned Stark. Remember the famous words, "She is of the North," under the orders of Robert Baratheon at Cersei's urging, following Nymeria's attack on Joffrey. So even though it wasn't Lady that did it, she couldn't get her hands on Nymeria, so she said, "Let's just kill this other one instead." And Robert had to go with that, and Ned Stark didn't want just a headsman to kill this precious direwolf, so he did it himself.
Bullshit.
So that brings us to number 3, Nymeria, was Arya's direwolf. And fearing for her life, Arya chased away the wolf cub after the attack. So she was still young. That was a while ago. We haven't seen her then. We assume she's loose somewhere in the Riverlands, but she is at large. Number 4 was Summer. This is Bran's wolf. He is north of the wall. They fled Winterfell following the castle sacking. And Summer was important because this is the first time we got to see Bran was warging into a wolf. Number 5 is Shaggy Dog, Rickon's direwolf. And he is assumed in hiding. He fled with Rickon after they separated from Bran and company and went with him and Asha somewhere into hiding. And finally, we have Ghost, who is Jon Snow's direwolf, an albino with red eyes, the runt of the litter, who followed Jon and his service beyond the wall and back to Castle Black.
He's badass. I love direwolves. I love them.
Yeah, I just want to say briefly that, these 6 children adopted the 6 orphan direwolf cubs that they found in the Wolf's Wood. And this was a big deal because it was the former sigil of their house. We saw Summer save Bran's life when the assassin came in. Catelyn had been unsure of the wolves until that point, and when she saw this, she insisted that Summer stay by Bran's side until he recovered. Grey Wind played a vital part in Robb's victory at the Battle of the Oxcross, and he was kind of in there ripping out throats right alongside Robb. He also seemed to be able to to detect Rob's enemies, so Catelyn always wanted him by Rob's side to sniff out somebody bad. And in fact, he was left outside during the wedding, and, you know, look what happened.
Yeah.
Nymeria protected Arya when she thought Joffrey was going to hurt her. So they were an important part of the storyline. They were their protectors, and there's also a lot of history behind these wolves. You know, they were almost near mythical creatures. There were larger populations of them in the north in past centuries, but their territory was pushed back. So there's been confirmed sightings by the Night's Watch north of the Wall. But by the reign of Robert Baratheon, no direwolf had been sighted south of the Wall, even in Starklands, for over 200 years. So it was sort of a big deal when they found them just hanging out in the woods, and you felt that it was fated for them to find these dogs. There were six wolves for six children, the sigil of their house. It seemed like it was going to be the equivalent of Dany and her dragons. They were playing that up for a long time, and then it sort of just fell off the radar.
I hope it comes back, because I really like them. I just like magical shit.
Yeah, so that's our Wolf Watch. Let us know if you see them, where they are, what they're doing.
Email us at contact@coffeeclatchcrew.com.
We look forward to hearing from you.
All right, that was Season 5, Episode 2. As you can tell by how long this podcast is, we really enjoyed that episode. There was so much to talk about. Rate us on iTunes. Give us a 4-star rating, 5-star rating, 12-star rating. There's not that many stars, but give it to us anyways. And write a review. This lets iTunes know who we are and helps us gain a bigger audience. Also, if you're going to do some shopping, summer's coming, you need some new clothes, you want some new toys to play with, everyone shops at Amazon. They're cheaper than the stores. You don't have to go anywhere. It's shipped right to you. Pretty soon they'll have drones shipping it to you, but that's not there yet. Just go to our website, coffeeclatchcrew.com. Bookmark that so you always have it there. Click on our Amazon links. We have two banners, one on the main page and a side banner on the podcast page. Click on that. It brings you right to Amazon. Do your shopping. It lets Amazon know that you're fans of ours and they love us for it. They give us a kickback.
Okay, and we'll be back next week for Episode 3, High Sparrow.
This round's on me. Leo, we love you.
This round is on me.
Please hang up and try again.